Imagine for a second that you've just hired a high-powered executive coach.
Oh, yeah, like top tier.
Exactly, top tier. We are talking like $500 an hour.
Wow, okay.
Right, and you are navigating this massive career transition. Maybe you're stepping into a new CEO role or, I don't know, spearheading a highly volatile merger.
Sounds incredibly stressful.
Oh, completely. And this coach is sitting across from you in this sleek, glass-walled office, asking all the right questions.
Right, they're totally poised.
Very poised, they're insightful, and they seemingly have the entire corporate universe figured out. But sitting across from them, soaking in all their expert guidance, it begs this hidden, almost counterintuitive question.
Which is?
When this incredibly highly paid expert coach gets stuck or, overwhelmed or completely lost in the weeds of your problems, who exactly coaches them?
Yeah, it is the ultimate behind the scenes question, isn't
It
it?
really is.
Because we tend to assume the experts at the top of the mountain just, well, they just possess all the answers
Like
inherently.
they're just born with it.
Right, we look at them as finished products. But the reality of how they maintain that level of insight is far more complex. It relies on an entirely hidden architecture of support.
Okay, let's unpack this because today's deep dive is pulling back the curtain on the booming executive coaching industry.
And it is a fascinating curtain to pull back.
Definitely. We're looking at a 2013 doctoral dissertation out of the University of Pennsylvania. It's by David J. DeFilippo, titled Executive Coach Supervision: The Dynamics and Effects.
A really grounded, deep piece of research.
It is. So our mission today is to explore this concept of coach supervision.
Which most people have never even heard of.
Never. But it's this rigorous, highly emotional, and surprisingly intricate process where the ultimate advice givers go to stay sharp.
Right, to avoid burnout and untangle the messy corporate webs they get caught in.
Exactly. We are taking a look at how the guides get guided.
And to really understand why this hidden layer of support is even necessary in the first place, we really have to look at the historical state of the coaching industry itself.
Because it wasn't always so structured, right?
Oh, not at all. By the mid-2000s, executive coaching had exploded. I mean, it became a $2 billion global industry almost overnight.
That is massive.
Huge. But it had a fundamental structural flaw. It had almost zero barriers to entry.
Right. So literally anyone could just print a business card that said, executive coach, throw up a website and start charging for advice.
Exactly. The only real requirement was your ability to attract clients.
You didn't need a medical license. You
Yeah.
didn't need to pass a bar exam or anything.
Nothing. It was essentially the Wild West of professional development.
Wild West. I like that.
Yeah, and the thought leaders within the field eventually realized that if coaching wanted to be taken seriously, if it wanted to evolve from just a trendy corporate perk into a true rigorous profession like medicine or law,
It desperately needed quality control.
precisely. It needed a mechanism for quality control and continuing education. So they looked to adjacent fields and borrowed the concept of supervision directly from psychotherapy.
And the historical context of that is amazing to me because therapeutic supervision traces its roots all the way back to Sigmund Freud.
Yes, all the way back to Vienna.
Right. In 1902, Freud started the Wednesday Psychological Society. He and his peers, figures like Alfred Adler, would meet weekly at Freud's apartment.
Smoke some cigars, probably.
Oh, definitely smoking cigars. And they'd discuss their psychotherapy cases. It wasn't just a social club, though. It was a systematic way to reflect on their practice and catch their own professional blind spots.
And that concept of peer reflection is exactly what modern coaching adapted. But the text is very careful to draw strict distinctions here.
Okay, distinctions between what?
Between consulting, therapy, and coaching. Because you already understand the strict boundaries there, you'll find the application of therapeutic supervision here particularly fascinating.
Right, because consulting provides specific analytical solutions to organizational problems. You hire a consultant to fix a broken supply chain.
Exactly. And we know therapy treats underlying psychological pathology, often looking backward to heal past trauma.
But coaching is fundamentally about facilitating self-discovery for performance improvement. It is entirely forward-looking.
Yes, forward-looking and performance-driven.
I am glad you brought up that distinction, but I have to push back on the premise for a second here.
Okay, go for it.
Wait, if a coach is just facilitating self-discovery, if they aren't treating trauma and they aren't fixing supply chains, why do they even need a supervisor?
That's a fair question.
Isn't it just active listening? I mean, you sit there, you mirror their body language, you ask, how does that make you feel? And you collect your fee. Why does a coach need their own coach just to facilitate a conversation.
The distinction is subtle, but what's fascinating here is that coaching at the executive level is so much more than just active listening.
More than just nodding along.
Much more. You are not just a passive sounding board. When you coach a CEO, you are entering an incredibly dynamic, often volatile human system.
Okay, that makes sense.
The research actually outlines three specific critical purposes for coach supervision. First is developmental.
Which means what exactly?
Growing the coach's actual skills, challenging their interventions, and helping them overcome their own cognitive biases.
Got it. What's the second?
Second is resourcing. That's providing emotional support to prevent burnout from absorbing the immense stress of top-tier executives.
And a third?
Third is qualitative, which is the quality control aspect, ensuring the organization that is footing the bill actually gets its money's worth and that ethical standards are maintained.
You know, that developmental piece completely reframes it for me. It makes me think as an elite athlete.
How so?
Well, a professional quarterback doesn't just play the game on Sunday, right?
Mm-hmm.
On Monday morning, they sit down in a dark film room with the head coach and review the game tape.
Ah, yes. They watch the playback.
Exactly. They need someone else to say, look at your footwork here, or your eyes dropped and you completely missed the open receiver on the left.
Because you can't see it yourself in the moment.
You simply cannot see your own technique when you are the one in the pocket taking the hits. The supervisor is the one reviewing the tape with the coach.
That is a brilliant way to visualize it, because the coach is actively participating in the dialogue, their own biases, their own assumptions.
Their own triggers.
Yes, their own triggers are inevitably going to creep in. You cannot observe a system without altering it, and you cannot be in a system without it altering you.
That's profound.
And because they are dealing with high-level executives, they often get pulled into incredibly complicated, multi-layered workplace dynamics.
Which naturally leads us to the actual mechanics of this. How does a supervisor actually help a coach untangle these corporate messes?
It takes a very specific framework.
Because they aren't just dealing with one person in a vacuum, right? They're dealing with a person who has a demanding boss, a fractured board of directors, stressed direct reports, and a toxic company culture.
To manage that immense complexity, the text introduces a framework known as the Seven-Eyed Coach Supervision Model.
Seven eyes, that sounds intense.
It was originally developed by Peter Hawkins and Robin Shohei. It's a brilliant framework that forces the supervisor to look at the coaching engagement from seven distinct shifting perspectives.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Break down how a supervisor actually shifts through these seven distinct lenses. Because it sounds like a massive cognitive load.
Oh, it requires immense mental agility. Let's walk through how they shift. I1 focuses purely on the coachee.
So just asking, what is the client's actual problem?
Exactly. Then I2 shifts to the coach's interventions. What specific techniques is the coach using, and are they effective?
Okay, that makes sense. And I3?
I3 looks at the relationship between the coach and the coachee. For example, is there an unhealthy dependency building?
Oh, that's a good one to watch out for.
Then I4 turns inward to the coach's own self-awareness. What personal biases is the coach bringing into the room?
So it's getting deeper. What's I5?
I5 zooms out to the supervisory relationship itself. What is happening in the room right now between the coach and the supervisor?
So it's super meta at that point.
Very meta. I6 is the supervisor's own self-reflection. And finally, I7 zooms all the way out to the wider organizational context.
The culture, the stakeholders, the systemic forces at play.
Exactly. All the external pressures.
Let's ground this a bit, because the source material gives a fantastic specific example of this model in action.
Yes, the disconnected coach.
Right. There was a coach in the study who went to their supervisor feeling mysteriously disconnected from a client. They had great rapport for months. But suddenly, the sessions felt incredibly awkward.
Unproductive and fuzzy, yeah.
Totally fuzzy. The coach was totally stumped. So the supervisor starts running the situation through this seven-eyed model.
Yes. They look at the interventions, they look at the relationship, but when they shift to I7, that wider organizational context, the entire picture changes.
How so?
As the supervisor listened to the coach describe the corporate structure, they started feeling a profound sense of confusion themselves. The corporate structure was a labyrinth of competing interests.
So the supervisor felt the confusion the coach was trapped in.
Exactly. And this prompted the supervisor to ask the crucial paradigm-shifting question, who is the actual client here?
Wow.
Is it the person sitting in front of the coach? Is it the associate company they collaborate with? Or is it the organizational stakeholders who are actually signing the checks?
Because the coach was completely trapped in a maze of corporate politics, they were subconsciously trying to pacify the board of directors, the boss, and the client all at once.
And as a result, they were connecting with absolutely no one.
I think of the supervisor's role here as providing a helicopter view, which is actually a term De Filippo's text uses.
It's a great metaphor.
Imagine you are lost in a giant claustrophobic corn maze.
Yeah.
You keep hitting dead ends. The walls all look exactly the same. You are frustrated.
And you can only see the corn stalks 3 inches in front of your face.
Right. The supervisor doesn't just walk into the maze with a map and tell you to turn left. They pull you up into a helicopter.
So you can see the whole layout.
Suddenly, you look down from 1,000 feet up and say, oh, I see the whole pattern now. I see exactly where I took the wrong turn.
And that realization is the magic of the process. Because if we connect this to the bigger picture, that helicopter view demonstrates why the supervisor must play a very delicate, almost restrained role.
Restrained in what way?
Well, they are a facilitator, not a dictator providing the answers. If the supervisor just looks down from the helicopter and says through a megaphone, take 3 steps left and turn right, they are treating the coach like a subordinate.
Right, they're just giving them the answers.
Exactly, and that robs the coach of their own learning and critical thinking. Instead, the supervisor creates a space where the coach can process the fuzziness of their own engagements.
They help the coach map out the friction and untangle the web themselves.
Yes, self-discovery.
But looking at the org chart through that seventh eye inevitably uncovers friction. And when a coach maps out that friction, they don't just intellectually observe it, they absorb it.
They absolutely do.
Which brings us to the immense emotional toll this takes. Untangling these corporate mazes isn't just a logistical puzzle, you know. It isn't just moving pieces on a chessboard. The raw emotional reality of the coaching room is intense.
It is arguably the most taxing part of the profession. The text details how coaches frequently bring feelings of being deeply stuck, incompetent, or profoundly anxious to their supervision sessions.
And where's all that anxiety coming from?
This is where we have to look at the neuroscience of emotion. The research discusses the open-loop nature of our limbic system.
Open-loop, what does that mean?
Well, unlike our circulatory system, which is closed and self-contained, our emotional regulatory system is open. It relies on external connections. This allows our moods to actually influence and regulate one another.
Oh, wow.
The clinical term for this is limbic resonance.
So essentially, we broadcast our emotional states. Emotions are biologically contagious.
Highly contagious. Mammals literally regulate each other's nervous systems. And in a highly attuned coaching dynamic, this leads to a phenomenon known as transference.
Which means the coach catches the feelings.
Essentially, yes. The coach doesn't just understand the client's emotional state. They actually absorb the emotional state of the coachee into their own nervous system.
That sounds exhausting. And the text shares a really powerful, visceral story about this involving coach supervisor number 4 and coach number 5.
Yes, the job interview case.
Right. Coach number 5 had been working closely with a client to prepare for a massive, career-defining job interview. But the client didn't get the job.
Which is devastating.
Devastating.
Yeah.
So coach number 5 goes into supervision and is carrying this intense, crushing guilt. She literally described feeling maternal toward her client, feeling completely responsible for his failure.
And what happens to the supervisor in that moment?
As she is explaining this, the supervisor physically feels her own heartbeat start to race. The supervisor realized she was physiologically mirroring the exact anxiety that the coach was feeling.
It passes right up the chain.
Exactly. One supervisor in the study even described these absorbed emotions hitting them like a freight train.
It is a striking visual, isn't it? The supervisor is sitting in a quiet room, and suddenly the anxiety, the maternal guilt, the raw pressure of the coachee's workplace is barreling down the tracks right into the supervision session.
I have to admit, I'm struggling with this emotional absorption piece.
How so?
Shouldn't these highly paid, trained professionals have an objective shield up? I mean, if a trauma surgeon gets emotionally devastated and takes on the grief of every family when a surgery gets complicated, they literally cannot do their job.
They'd burn out immediately.
They would collapse in a week. Why is coaching different? Why isn't building a thick, objective, emotional shield the ultimate goal here?
You are bringing up the classic medical model of detachment. And honestly, this raises an important question about the very nature of effective coaching versus other disciplines.
Okay, lay it on me.
True coaching requires deep, authentic empathy to function. If you put up an impenetrable objective shield, you cease to be a coach. You become a consultant just handing over a spreadsheet of best practices.
I see.
To truly facilitate someone's deep self-discovery, you have to connect with them on a deeply human level. You have to build immense trust. And when you open yourself up to build that trust, absorbing some of their emotional reality is simply inevitable.
You cannot swim in the water without getting wet.
Exactly.
Okay, I see the distinction. So they have to take on this emotional weight to do the job effectively. But they clearly can't just carry the corporate trauma of 20 different executives around with them forever.
No, and that is where the resourcing function of the supervisor becomes a lifeline. The supervisor provides what psychological literature, specifically drawing from Donald Winnicott, calls a holding environment.
A holding environment. What does that look like?
It is a safe, strictly confidential space where the coach can experience what we call productive discomfort. They can process these absorbed emotions, look at them without judgment, and meticulously separate what belongs to the client from what belongs to them.
It's like an airlock. You step in, decontaminate, and figure out whose anxiety you are actually wearing.
That's a great way to put it.
So experiencing that freight train of emotion isn't a sign of weakness. It's the crucible required to reach a professional breakthrough. Which brings us to the ultimate outcomes.
Right, the real benefit of all this.
What does a coach actually get out of enduring this intense supervision process? The research gives us another incredible specific moment, this time between coach number one and coach supervisor number two, that illustrates this perfectly.
Yes, this is a beautiful example of how supervision directly impacts a coach's internal capability. Coach number one was really struggling with her confidence.
She felt like she wasn't doing a good job.
Exactly. She was bringing a massive amount of self-doubt into the supervision session, questioning her own instincts and her value to her clients.
Right. And as they're talking through this doubt, the supervisor suddenly gets this vivid, random visual image in her head.
Out of nowhere.
Completely out of nowhere. She pictures a ballet dancer pulling up through her core, maintaining absolute poise, grace, and balance under immense physical strain.
Such a powerful image.
It really is. So the supervisor takes a risk and shares this image out loud. And astonishingly, the coach says, "Oh my God." Because at that exact same microsecond, the coach had been thinking of her own daughter, who dances as a ballerina.
It was a moment of profound, unconscious synchronicity, and we have to look at why that matters.
Why does it matter so much?
Because that shared visual breakthrough completely shifted the coach's perspective. It wasn't magic, it was empirical evidence. It proved to the coach that she was highly attuned and deeply connected to the subtle, unspoken cues in the room.
It proved she wasn't just making it up.
Exactly. It culminated in the coach having this incredible realization where she exclaimed, "I am damned good at what I do."
It proved she possessed the exact emotional attunement required to be a great coach. And the physical relief they describe in the text after these breakthroughs is so visceral.
Oh, absolutely.
Coaches literally talked about feeling physically lighter, describing the aftermath of a supervision session as a weight going off my shoulders.
Like they can breathe again.
Yes. They walk in carrying the corporate baggage of five different C-suite executives, and they walk out feeling grounded, recalibrated, and ready to go back into the fray.
But the supervisor's job isn't just to be an ongoing weekly pressure release valve. The ultimate long-term goal of the supervision process is actually something called self-supervision.
Self-supervision, meaning they eventually graduate and don't need the supervisor anymore.
In a practical sense, yes. Over time, the coach internalizes the supervisor's voice. They learn the frameworks, like the seven-eyed model, so deeply that it becomes second nature.
So they do it automatically.
Right. They can start to self-correct in real time while they're sitting across from their own clients. They can feel their own heartbeat rising. They can feel themselves getting overly maternal or defensive. And that internalized supervisor's voice kicks in.
Saying what?
Saying, take a step back. What lens are you looking through? Look at the wider context.
When you put all of these pieces together, the emotional processing, the framework, the internalized voice, so what does this all mean for the daily practice of the coach?
It changes everything.
It reminds me of installing an automated diagnostic script on a computer network.
Oh, I like that analogy.
At first, you need the IT technician, the supervisor, to manually run the ping tests to find exactly where your emotional reactions are dropping packets or picking up malware from your clients.
Right, checking for vulnerabilities.
Exactly. But eventually, your brain runs that diagnostic script in the background automatically. It catches your own defensiveness or bias before it ever reaches the client, keeping your mental operating system totally clean.
That is exactly the mechanism at play. It becomes an automated internal reflex. But the text also includes a very important, stark warning about the supervisory relationship itself.
What's the warning?
There is a very real danger of the coach and the supervisor getting too cozy.
Because the industry is small, right? They often know each other, they go to the same conferences, they move in the exact same professional circles.
Precisely. And if the supervision session just devolves into a friendly chat over coffee where they just, you know, vent about difficult clients,
you lose the edge.
You risk something called collusion. You completely lose the critical challenge, the productive discomfort that is absolutely required for growth.
That makes total sense.
A good supervisor has to be willing to push back, to ask the hard questions, and hold up an unflattering mirror, even when it creates tension in the room.
If they are just validating every choice you make and telling you you're right, you aren't growing, you're just paying a premium hourly rate for a friend.
And that defeats the entire architectural purpose of the system. When done correctly, with rigor and challenge, this is how the coaching profession elevates itself.
It grows up.
Yes. It moves away from being a wild west of uncredentialed advice givers and becomes a highly trusted, rigorous discipline. The supervisor acts as the invisible client in the room.
The invisible client.
Right. They are entirely behind the scenes, never seen by the executive, but they are ultimately ensuring that the end user gets the highest quality, most objective, and most ethically sound guidance possible.
It is an incredible hidden architecture. We spend so much time in our culture looking at the visible leaders, you know, the people at the podium, the high-powered executives, and even the coaches who guide them.
The people on the stage.
Right. But behind every great guide, there is almost always another guide helping them navigate the fog. The people we rely on to untangle our messes desperately need a safe space to untangle their own.
It's a continuous chain of support. And without that invisible link, without that holding environment, the whole system is entirely vulnerable to burnout, bias, and collapse.
It really makes you reflect on your own life and the systems you operate in. Think about it. Whether you are managing a team at the office, mentoring a junior colleague through a tough project, or even just acting as the designated therapist friend for your social circle.
Which is a heavy burden.
It is. You are absorbing emotional weight. You are taking on the freight train of other people's problems and mapping out their friction. So, who is your supervisor? Where is your safe space to process that so you don't burn out or lose your own perspective?
We all need a holding environment. We all need someone with the ability to pull us up into the helicopter when we are lost in the maze.
Exactly. So here is a final thought to leave you with, something to mull over the next time you are in the room with an expert. The next time you seek advice from a highly paid professional, a doctor, a lawyer, a leader, or a coach sitting across from you in a sleek, glass-walled office.
Yeah.
Ask yourself.
Yeah, who do they go to?
Exactly. Who do they go to when they are stuck? What hidden chain of support, what invisible supervisor is quietly influencing the very advice you are receiving right now?